please welcome, of all places, to Riverbend Center, Mr. David Sayre. The problem wasn't the protesters, but the infernal helicopters sent to monitor them. They were huge, these things, like whales with blades on top. And the racket they made was deafening and incessant. Even in my office, with noise-canceling headphones on, I could hear them hanging in the air for hours at a time. Imagine them as constant, Hugh said. Imagine living with noise like that for years on end. His goal, of course, was to induce shame, to highlight my selfishness and wake me from my coma of petty self-interest. People are dying, but you only care when it affects you personally. The first time I heard this, when I was 5 or something, it caused me to take a step back. Now, though, I'm like, and? You're not helping, I told him. Then I plugged my headphones into my iPod and listened to Ethel Merman, the only person forceful enough to drown out a jumbo helicopter. As an added measure, I pulled out the vacuum and used it on the stairs until I blew a fuse. This, I thought, is what Israel has reduced me to. Or was it Hamas I should have been angry at? As with most end-of-the-year news stories, I felt that I had come into this one too late. Here I was, still listening to Christmas records, while inside my neglected television, the Holy Land was going to hell in a handbasket. I did finally pick up a paper. Across the front page were pictures of shelled buildings and dead people lying face down in the rubble. Is this today's Guardian or one from last year? I found myself wondering. When it comes to the Israelis and the Palestinians, it seems like the same story over and over, not to reduce it to a Tom and Jerry cartoon. But after a while, you can't help but lose patience. Those two are at it again, being the common response. It seems you could resettle these people, separate them by mountains and oceans, and still they'd find a way to pound on each other. Or would they? I needed someone to take it from the top and explain things step by step. But everyone I talked to seemed to have made their mind up long ago, and what they told me sounded like propaganda rather than information. Then, too, it makes me uncomfortable to dislike Israel. It's the same feeling I get when burning a book. I see it in the fireplace, just starting to catch, and get overwhelmed by unpleasant associations, even when they're galleys I'm burning, even when they're books I wrote. You can disagree with Israel, but still like the Jews, someone told me, and though I agree that it is certainly possible, I think it's much easier just not to think about it. Thus, I put the blame on England. That's who the helicopters belong to. And that, when it comes down to it, was what was really bothering me. There's a number you can call to complain about noise, so I gave it a try, thinking as I dialed, how American, which is to say whiny, I was going to sound. Yes, hello. There's a potential riot taking place a few blocks away, and it's forcing me to listen to show tunes rather than the gentle Christmas music I normally prefer at this time of year. It turns out that the noise office was closed for the night, and instead of leaving a message, I hung up. As the helicopters continued to throb, I considered phoning 999, the British equivalent of 911. Then I remembered a news report on this very subject. people dialing emergency services for things that aren't real emergencies. This man, for example, who called to complain about a pizza. It seems he'd ordered it plain, and when it was delivered with mushrooms on top, what could he do but summon the police? My call, of course, would be no less ridiculous. And so it was back to Gypsy. I did eventually talk to a policeman, though it was face-to-face rather than on the phone. "What's with the hovering?" I asked. And he explained that the people aboard the helicopter were shooting security videos at night. "It's infrared," he told me. "Well, do they have to do it here?" The cop was kind enough to ignore my last question. As we moved into January, the protests grew larger and more organized. I was at the bus stop one afternoon and noticed beside me a child the size of a chimp. In his arms was a sign written on poster board, and as I turned, he held it aloft and waved it at my chest. "Stop the Holocaust in Gaza," it read. I've always had a problem with protesting children, or at least those protesting on behalf of their parents. If a 5-year-old wants to denounce spankings or travel on his own steam to demand more candy and potato chips, I'm behind him 100%. Otherwise, I just see him as a pawn. Of course, in Gaza, many of the victims were around this boy's age. You saw them in the newspapers, limp, bloody bundles in the arms of their wailing parents. So maybe in this case, a protesting child could claim self-interest. At the start of the campaign, demonstrators gathered directly in front of the Israeli embassy, a grand mansion set beside other mansions on a tree-lined street bordering the western edge of Kensington Gardens. At either end of the street are guardhouses, and in order to pass the gates, drivers must show their credentials. Anyone can walk in, though, and on the first day of the protest, a great many did. 10,000 was the number I read in the newspaper. With dusk came the helicopters, which bobbed overhead until 9 o'clock. As the campaign progressed, the row of mansions was closed off, and the protesters moved a block south onto Kensington High Street. Among the signs I started to see were, predictably, "Stop the slaughter," and maybe not so predictably, "Ashamed to be an Israeli." I was on the bus when I noticed that one. The woman beside me saw it at the same time and said quietly, "Yes." And it was this, the whisper of a complete stranger, that settled my internal debate. The Palestinians were right, pure and simple, at least until the following afternoon, when from the same bus, while passing the same patch of sidewalk, I saw a sign reading, "Death to Israel." Then I was back to square one and determined not to waver. I walked home from my stop that evening, and as the helicopter droned overhead, I cursed the Palestinian people for destroying my peace of mind. 2 days later, I was back in their camp, so to speak. But only until a group of pro-Hamas demonstrators broke into a Starbucks and started throwing mugs at the police, at which point I switched back to the other side. Not because I love Starbucks, but just because mugs. Come on. The helicopter, meanwhile, continues to hover. Fists are waved, barricades are breached, and Ethel Merman advances from some people to a thunderous and heart-wrenching small world.
Bonnie, you're a stranger who's come here.
Try to play music, and it felt really queer. I've never done that before. I wanted to write stories for certain songs, and then I was wondering what it would be like then to play the songs. And I just felt like my fly was down. That's all. Let's just pretend that that never happened. This is a story that was in the New Yorker a few weeks ago. And my editor came up with a title for it. It was like a working title, and I think she called it On the Road. And then she wrote me just before they went to press and said, oh, we just ran a story with that title. Can you come up with something else? And so I said, I wrote her a message, and I said, what about author? But I put the question mark in the quotation marks, and so they titled it author. But I had been thinking author. If anything should be bracketed by matching bookends, I suppose it's an author tour. The ones I've undertaken in the past had begun in one independent or chain store and ended a month or so later in another. The landscape, though, has changed since then, and it's telling that on this latest tour, I started and finished at a Costco. The first one I went to was in Winston-Salem, North Carolina. I was spending the weekend with my sister Lisa, just gearing up for 6 weeks of travel, when her husband Bob expressed a need for light bulbs. Anyone game for a quick ride to Costco, he asked. And before he could even find his keys, I was panting, dog-like, beside the front door. Living in cities, it's easy to avoid the big box superstores, their merciless lighting, their stench of rubber and cheap molded plastic. It's not the way I normally like to shop. At Costco, though, I found these displays of pain relievers. Anacin, Bayer, Tylenol. 8 major brands were represented. Pills were paired into single-serving envelopes, then stapled in rows to a bright sheet of poster board. It looked like something you'd find behind the counter at a gas station. There, the packets might cost $2 each, but here the entire display, maybe 150 doses, went for just $12. At home, I'd buy a bottle of Bufferin or ibuprofen and leave it at that. But when I'm on tour, it's packets I need. Not for myself, but to give as gifts to the people who have come to see me. Say it's someone's birthday or anniversary. I always offer the shampoos and conditioners taken from my hotels. But they provide only so many, and with a good-sized crowd, you're empty-handed before you know it. Adults get something for special occasions, but the bulk of my presents go to teenagers, who qualify by virtue of their very existence. Real fun is right at their fingertips, but instead of taking bong hits in a stolen car, or getting pregnant in a neighbor's tool shed, they'd come to a bookstore to hear a middle-aged man read out loud. And for that, they deserve a token of my gratitude. The beauty of pain relievers is that they're light and easy to pack. On top of that, they're actually useful. Here you are, I'll say to a 16-year-old. Put this in your purse or glove compartment and think of me the next time you get a hangover. For this last tour, my gifts were pretty paltry. I'd bought 8 dozen safety pins in Greece, and while they were foreign, they didn't look much different from what you could get in the States. Ditto the German Band-Aids. So when Bob mentioned Costco, I felt that all my problems had been solved. As with every other big box store in Winston-Salem, it took 15 minutes to drive there, and another 15 minutes to cross the parking lot. If the building seemed large from the outside, inside it was twice as big, the kind of space that has its own weather. The carts, too, were slightly oversized, and made me appear even smaller than I actually am. Pushing one toward the hardware section, My brother-in-law and I looked like a pair of 12-year-olds. The sort with that disease that speeds up the aging process and leaves them wizened and tragic. This store didn't have the light bulb Bob wanted, so we trudged on to the drug section, which proved equally disappointing. Pain relievers were in 10-gallon jars rather than packets. So I looked around for another gift that a teenager might appreciate. I wanted something light and individually wrapped. It settled, finally, upon a gross of condoms, which came in a box the size of a cinder block. It was a lot of protection, but not a lot of weight. Like that. All right, I said to Bob, I think these should do the trick. Putting them in the cart, I thought nothing of it, but a moment later, walking down the aisle with my 59-year-old brother-in-law, I started feeling patently, almost titanically gay. Maybe I was imagining things, but it seemed as if people were staring at us. People in families, mostly, led by thrifty and disapproving parents, who looked at what we were buying and narrowed their eyes in judgment. You homosexuals, their faces seemed to say. Is that all you ever think about? Thick, graying hair, a matching mustache, and squarish, wire-rimmed glasses. I never imagined him as gay, much less as my boyfriend. But now I couldn't stop. We've got to get something else in this car. Bob disappeared into the acreage reserved for produce. I returned a minute later with a 4-pound box of strawberries. This somehow made us look even gayer. After anal sex, we like shortcake. Bubble now floating over our heads. Something else, I said, we've got to get something else. Bob, oblivious, looked up at the rafters and thought for a moment, I guess I can use some olive oil. Forget it, I told him. Let's just pay up and go. Can we do that, please? TSA inspectors must have thought. My tour began, and every few days, upon arriving in some new city, I'd find a slip of paper in my suitcase, the kind they throw in after going through all your stuff. 5 dress shirts, 3 pairs of pants, underwear, a doc kit full of band-aids and safety pins, 2 neckties, and several hundred rubbers. What sort of person does a mind cobble together from these ingredients? As the weeks passed, my suitcase grew more and more conventional. I got something for you, I'd say to a teenager. Nothing huge, just a little something to show that I care. The kids who went to good schools would roll their eyes. I can get those in the health realm, they told me. And in the voice of a person whose upbringing was so fundamentally different that he might as well have been raised by shepherds, I would say, really? For free? Unlike a lot of authors I know, I enjoyed my book tours. Love them, as a matter of fact. That said, I'm in a fortunate position and have been able to eliminate the parts that don't agree with me. The picture-taking, for instance. People all have cameras on their cell phones now, and figuring, I guess, that they might as well aim them at something, they'd ask me to stand and pose a good 30 times a night. This wasn't an inconvenience so much as an embarrassment. You could do better than me, I tell them. And when they insisted that they really couldn't, I'd feel even worse. Thus, at readings, there's now a sign propped atop my book signing table. Sorry, it announces, but we don't allow photos. This makes it sound like it's the store's idea. A standard policy, like no eating fudge in the fine arts section. If it's their rule, I guess I have to go along with it, I tell people, sighing as if I were really disappointed. With the picture taken out of the way, I'm completely free to enjoy myself, which I generally do, and immensely. Every night after the half-hour reading and the 20 or so minutes of question and answer, I'll sit and talk to hundreds of strangers. This fellow, for instance, who I met on my first day in Toronto. I liked his glasses, and after asking where he had gotten them, we fell into the topic of corrective surgery. I hear that you have to remain conscious during the procedure, he told me, and that when the laser hits its target, you can actually smell your own eyeball. Sizzling. I thought about this for days. Just as I thought of the special ed teacher I met in Pittsburgh. You know, I said, I hear those words and automatically think handicapped or learning disabled. But aren't a lot of your students just assholes? She said. Then she told me about a kid, last day of class, who wrote on the blackboard, Mrs. Johnson is a cockmaster. I was impressed because I'd never heard that term before. She was impressed because the boy had spelled it correctly. For hours each night, I would talk to people, asking pretty much whatever I wanted. The trick, of course, is to match the right person with the right question. Take this young woman I met in Boston a few years back. I'd been signing for almost 6 hours, and when she finally stepped up to the table, my mind went blank. When did you last touch a monkey? I expected never, or it's been years. But instead, she took a step back, saying, oh, can you smell it on me? The young woman's name was Jennifer, and it turned out that she worked for Helping Hands, an organization that trains monkeys to work as slaves for paralyzed people. I visited the facility outside of Boston and spent a pleasant afternoon having my pockets picked by some of her cleverer students. On my most recent tour, my questions were pretty standard. What was the last reading you attended? Who are you going to use this condom on? If you stepped out of the shower and saw a leprechaun standing at the base of your toilet, would you scream, or would you innately understand that he meant you no harm? Late at night, I'd return to my room, scoop up the shampoos and conditioners, replaced as part of the turndown service, and record everything that I had learned, not just the stories that people had told me, but all the ephemera. The names of local restaurants and hair salons seen from the car window. One hotel with its Martini Tuesdays, another with its Fajita Fridays. In Baton Rouge, a woman asked me to name her donkey. Stephanie, I said. And later that night, too tired to sleep, I laid awake and wondered if I had spoken too quickly. In 2004, I offered priority signing to smokers. And the reason being that because they didn't have as long to live, their time was more valuable. This year, my special treatment was reserved for men who stood 5'6" and under. That's right, my little friends. There'll be no waiting in line for you. It seemed unfair to restrict myself to men, and so I included any woman with braces on her teeth. What about us? Asked the pregnant and the lame. And because it was my show, I told them to wait their fucking turn. United States, I flew to Canada to finish my tour. On my first night in Toronto, I rented a chain store called Indigo. That event ended at midnight, and the following afternoon, after half a dozen radio and print interviews, I was taken to Costco. Not to buy pain relievers and condoms, but to meet my readers. Or rather, not meet them. My appearance had been advertised by way of a flyer and was to last for no longer than an hour. Shoppers passed with their enormous carts, most loaded with children, who gazed through the bars at this ridiculous nobody, sitting by himself at a folding table, making it just that much more pathetic. Was the sign next to me, the big one reading, "No photos, please." Greatest pleasure not to take your picture. I imagine people thinking, I mean, really, just what the hell do you think you are? It's a question well suited to a cavernous space. There your eyes can roam heavenward, past the signs for frozen food and automotive supplies, past the arrow pointing to the cash registers, and on to that boundless parking lot, which leads eventually to home. Spend the next 2 hours sitting on the runway. When it happens to you, it's a national tragedy, on par with an actual plane crash. Why aren't the papers reporting this, you wonder? Only when it happens to someone else do you realize what a dull story it really is. They said we'd leave at 3 instead of 2:30, so I went and had a donut. And when I came back, they changed the time to 4 on account of the plane we'd be riding in hadn't left Pittsburgh yet. Then I was like, why didn't you tell us that an hour ago? And they were like, sir, just stand away from the counter, please. Because I'm in the air so often, I hear this sort of thing a lot. In line for a coffee, in line for a newspaper, or the peanuts or potato chips that are now only sold by the ton. Everywhere I go, someone in an $8 t-shirt is whipping out a cell phone and delivering the fine print of his or her delay. I should be used to the way Americans dress when traveling, but still it manages to shock me. It's as if the person next to you was washing shoe polish off a pig. then suddenly threw down his sponge, saying, "Fuck this! I'm going to Los Angeles!" It's not just men, either. Women in cutoffs, women in halter tops. What you hear over and over is, "I just want to be comfortable." Which leads me to wonder why these people left home in the first place. Especially to go to an airport, where being uncomfortable is now the rule rather than the exception. Still, though, there's the occasional bright spot. This announcement, for instance, heard by my friend Steve, who was waiting in Las Vegas for his flight back to Salt Lake City. "Anyone believing in the hereafter is now invited to board," said the woman behind the counter into the microphone. "I repeat, anyone who believes in the hereafter is now invited to board." Steve and his fellow ticket holders, all of them indignant, looked at each other. Did we hear her correctly? Is she giving special rights to Christians? She can't do that, can she? Shouldn't we sue or something just on principle? I imagine that the woman registered these looks, savoring them before repeating herself a third time and adding her little punchline. "Anyone believing in the hereafter is now invited to board. Otherwise, you'll be here after we take off." I was on a plane in the spring of 2003 when the flight attendant asked us to pray for our troops in Iraq. It was a prickly time, but brand new war or no brand new war, you don't ever want to hear the word pray from a flight attendant. You don't want to hear the phrase, "I'll be right back," either. That's code for go fuck yourself. This according to a woman who used to fly for Northwest, I think it was. We met at a book signing, and she taught me several terms specific to her profession. "You know how a plastic bottle of water will get all crinkly during a flight?" she asked. "Well, that happens to people, too. To our insides. That's why we get all gassy." "All right," I said. "So what me and the other gals would sometimes do is fart while we walked up and down the aisle. No one could hear it on account of the engine noise. But anyway, that's what we call crop dusting." Thank you so much for telling me that. I appreciated it too when another flight attendant, this one male, explained how he and his associates get things off their chests when it comes time to land. It's petty, I know, but what we do is walk down the aisle with a plastic garbage bag. Then we look each passenger in the eye and say, "You're trash." "You're trash." "Your family's trash." Nobody ever gets it, but God, does it feel good. Course catalog made it sound interesting, but once we got started, I could see that I had been misled. Part of the problem was the teacher, who was gray-haired and bearded and in his late 50s. Sobel, I think his last name was. To say that he was not a gifted public speaker would be putting it mildly. Neither did he know much about contemporary art, at least not the kind being bought and sold in New York. And that, to most of us, was the only kind that mattered. What this guy mainly knew about were murals, the sort done by poor people with spray paint. He'd drive to the west side of Chicago, photograph an underpass or the outside of a run-down school, and bring the slides to class. Then he'd project them onto the screen and proceed to talk until the darkness of the room and the dull cadence of his voice put most of my classmates to sleep. I found him as narcotic as everyone else did, but what kept me awake, and on my toes even, was the anticipation of certain words, one of them being Latino. What we see in many of these displaced Latino cultures is he took an undeniable pride in Chicano as well. But his real showstopper, the one that made the hairs on my arm stand up, was Nicaragua. I couldn't get enough of it. At the end of every class, he'd flick on the lights, ignoring the students who yawned and stretched and shielded their eyes against the sudden brightness. Are there any questions? Yes, I'd say. In that No More U.S. Intervention mural, what country specifically do you think the artist was talking about? Well, that would most clearly be Nicaragua. Then he'd look around the room, ask if there were any further questions, and frown a little at the sight of my hand. Back in the air and waving. Yes, I'd say, me again. Listen, this might sound beside the point, but which Central American country do you think grows the best coffee? He scratched his beard. Costa Rica? Which is second best, then? Well, there's El Salvador, certainly, but me personally, I would probably go with Nicaragua. Why do you ask? Just curious. Certainly, to a Spanish-speaking person, Nicaragua is pronounced Nicaragua. It wasn't the word itself that amused me, but the sound of it coming from certain mouths. Mouths most often that were nothing if not selective. You never heard such people ordering enchiladas. But if that was the name of a revolutionary leader, if Los Burritos Grandes was a mountain range amongst which toiled and oppressed peoples, well, that would be different. I think of this now because I have to. Living in another country, I am constantly having to decide how to say things. Take this dinner party I went to. There were 18 guests, and Hugh and I were the only Americans. I sat between a judge and a dentist. Double paranoia. For an illegal immigrant with teeth you can open cans with. But these were kind and interesting people who went out of their way to put me at ease. The subject of language school came up over dessert, and when the dentist asked me where I had studied, I said, Paris. If the party had taken place in America, or if the person asking the question was a native-born English speaker, I'd have answered, Paris, because it's queer to say Paris out of context. No more pretentious than, say, Nicaragua, but it's always viewed that way. Probably because they have better stuff in France. Shoes, palaces, and the like. Sometimes Hugh and I, or my American friend Kristen and I, will speak French amongst ourselves, But it's the weird tourist French we hear so often in the shops and restaurants of our neighborhoods. French that's spoken as if it were English. Donne-moi un coup de fil, a new Bouvant's there to course ensemble demand. D'accord? I should add that I am in absolutely no position to criticize anyone's French, especially when it comes to pronunciation. What I can criticize is a decision to speak it in the first place. A case in point would be this house guest we had in Normandy over the summer, an American who'd rented a car in Nice and was traveling across the country. Have you been to Tours? He asked. To Tours? No, Tours. He corrected me. It's up the where? Never been, I said. This is the same guest who on his second day decided to speak nothing but French. Not the flat, jokey kind, but the Nicaragua kind. This in front of his wife who speaks no French at all. I walked into the kitchen, and at the sound of his, Ah, David, qu'est-ce qu'on va faire aujourd'hui? I thought, oh, for the love of God. Really need to do this. I'm in my pajamas and I haven't even made coffee yet. When I look back on that weekend, what really shames me was my response. Asked in Nicaraguan French what we were slated to do that day, I looked out the window and said, Io tenke desne. This is Nicaraguan Japanese for nice weather, isn't it? Excusez-moi, our guest said. Mais je ne comprends pas ce que tu dis. He said that he hadn't understood me. And rather than explaining, I apologized. Sumimasen, demo, watashimo, wakarimasen. Which means sorry, but I don't understand either. Now here was the poor wife having to listen to two languages she couldn't make sense of. She hadn't had any coffee either. People are super impressed when they think that you speak Japanese. And completely without license, I basked in that admiration. My response to the next question was, Watashi tachi no oki otoko no ko Washington ni sundemasu. Gosh, the wife sighed. I just feel so unsophisticated. What I'd actually said was, our big boy lives in Washington. It's one of the phrases I'd memorized off an audio instructional program someone had given me. After working my way through 27 CDs, I went to Tokyo for 3 months and enrolled in school. That said, my Japanese is primitive, just enough to try on clothes in a department store or get a few laughs from a supermarket cashier. Showing off is what you were doing, he would later say. And rather than admitting that he was right, I said that I had been driven to it, which, in a way, was true. What really set me off was when the guest started correcting me. Bear in mind that he lives in the United States and just picked up his French, took no classes whatsoever. After slamming my pronunciation, he tried to bust me on definition. Like, for instance, we have all these wild rabbits in our yard. Hugh put in a vegetable garden, and now it looks like they're filming an Easter commercial. I mean to say that these things are everywhere. It's so bold. At first they'd run into the woods at the sound of a door opening, but now, if you throw a shoe at them, they'll scamper for a second, and then regroup to chew on the laces. We wanted to hate these rabbits for eating up all our plants, but then they're so cute. What are you gonna do? Like most couples, Hugh and I tend to divide the tasks. He replasters the walls of the attic, and I take dried up bees and dress them in suits of armor made of tinfoil. fills out the mountains of paperwork sent by our insurance company, and I decide what to call the various creatures that wander into our house or yard. Generally, I tend to stick with American names, normal ones like Becky or Sheila. Phil is always good, as is Curtis and Beth. Something about these rabbits, though, encouraged me to try something new. Not just French, the Nicaraguan French. As that was the only way to capture their insolence and bravado. The main one, for example, the one who's been eating our food the longest, I named Shagun. What does that mean exactly? The wife of our guest asked. I told her that the word was the same in French as it was in English, and that chagrin meant sorrow. Actually, it means regret, her husband said. Well, sorrowful regret, I told her. And what's that rabbit's name? She pointed to another, smaller one. That would be Kalaj. Wait a minute, her husband said. That means tile. Like you put in your bathroom or kitchen. I know that, I said. You can't call a rabbit tile. In French or English, what the hell kind of a name is that? A cute one, I told them. A third rabbit hopped into view, and before the wife could ask, I told her that its name was Chômage. You mean chômeur, her husband said. And he turned to his wife. Chômage means unemployment. And chômeur is an unemployed man, so that would be the rabbit's name. Unless, of course, it's a female, in which case it would be chômage. By this point, I'd had about all of this that I could take. It's my yard. The rabbit was my intruder. And I was free to name him whatever stupid thing I wanted. Be it a noun, a verb, even an adjective, if I felt like it. Oh, look at Runny, I could say. It appears that he and Moist are going to pay a visit to their old friend, screened-in patio. Better than my own. Making it all the harder is that he was a natural, a sort of genius perhaps, who could look at a word once and hold it in his mind forever. I've made it sound as if his speaking was a pretension, but come on, the guy was on vacation. He was in France and he wanted to practice. It's not his fault that I'm so easily threatened. I felt so bad after he left that I named a rabbit after him. Thank fucking God, he's gone. Isn't the most welcome presence in the garden. But as I often say to Hugh, he's definitely the quickest. There are several that serve the region and come out once a week. If it's not that hard to get written up in, say, the Atlanta Constitution, it's really, really not hard to find yourself in the Orne Combatant. In fact, it's hard to stay out of it. The farmer across the road from us, 80-year-old Robert Bub Gerben, was profiled 6 years ago. The man who truly whispers to horses about that. The picture was of him seeming to gossip into the ear of his Père Charon, a dappled mare built like a dump truck. Hugh's been in the paper as well, twice, as a matter of fact. The last story was about his landscape painting, and the one before that appeared in late October 2004. They wanted to talk to an American about the presidential election, a who do you hope will win sort of thing. The resulting article, Area man despises Bush. Considers him a threat to all living creatures. Was, said the hoarse whisperer, pow mal, meaning not bad. For this last election, the combattant interviewed our friend Mary Beth, who was born and raised outside of Boston, and moved to our neck of the woods after marrying her French husband. Being American, you wouldn't vote for a black man, would you? The reporter asked. Though crudely phrased, the question was fairly common, and not just in backwater Normandy. And the year before the election, I traveled pretty much nonstop. Italy, Greece, Germany, the Netherlands, Australia, Brazil, and all through the UK and Ireland. These were book tours, so I sat for a lot of radio and print interviews. In the US, unless you've written about politics, you don't expect political questions. Overseas, on the other hand, it's pretty much all you get, at least if you're an American. I could have put out a history of frosting or doll furniture. I could have written a novel in which all of the characters were dancing mushrooms. And the foreign papers would still have asked me about Guantanamo and my country's refusal to sign the Kyoto Accord. It's not that I don't have opinions about these things. I just don't feel they're in any way special. Sure, I follow the news. I read the papers and listen to the radio, but I'm not privy to any inside information. When it comes to politics, all I can offer is emotion. My perspective might be slightly different, but so is anyone's when they live overseas. I remember my dad calling after the Iraq War started and asking if I felt safe on the streets of Paris. He had the idea that the Europeans, and specifically the French, had become openly hostile and were targeting Americans, even throwing stuff at them. If that was happening, I neither saw it nor read about it. In my experience, people were curious. They had plenty of questions, but I was never insulted or singled out in any way. It might have felt different were I a Bush supporter, but as it was, the president brought my neighbors and I together. The sight of him causes your eyes to weep of the pus. The exact same occurrence happens to me. It was like the Small World Pavilion at Disneyland. Everyone on the same page. As the primaries began, so did the predictions. The reporters in Greece, the ones in Australia, in Amsterdam, in Dublin, all of them assured me that America would never elect a black president. Maybe, I said, but I'll bet you that half of America could elect a half-black president. No way, said the German, who'd once spent a week in Los Angeles. The Brazilian, whose wife was from Tennessee. The Englishman, who'd seen Barack 4 times. Everyone was an expert, and what they knew was this. Americans are racist. It always sounds false when white people talk about how gentle and colorblind they are. One thing I've learned from my many Asian, Latino, and African-American friends is that we're all brothers under the skin. Statements like this make me queasy, but they're really no worse than, how could I be racist when my first boyfriend was black? My first boyfriend was black as well. But that doesn't prove I'm colorblind. Just that I like big butts. If I'm walking down an American street and anyone darker than a peanut shell approaches, I'll say, hello. This because if I don't, he or she might think that I'm anxious, which of course I must be, otherwise I'd just walk by in silence, the way I do with my fellow Caucasians. Does this make me racist or just race conscious? Either way, I'm more afraid of conservatives than I am of black people. I think a lot of Americans are. Thus, when questioned by foreign journalists, I predict with confidence that Obama would win. This would get me a shake of the head and a look that translated in five languages to, poor dreamer. As in every election since 1998, I voted absentee and spent the month of October traveling across the United States on a lecture tour. It was all a presidential campaign all the time, and what I liked was the directness of it. In France, there's a far-right political party called the National Front. Blame the immigrants, stop building mosques, down with the EU. Their policies are fairly predictable. The National Front's leader, Jean-Marie Le Pen, defined the Nazi occupation of his country as not particularly inhumane. It has 25 convictions against him, an assortment ranging from grievous bodily harm to anti-Semitism to condoning war crimes. He's an older guy, pale, his eyes made small by thick-lensed glasses. When political campaigns are held in France, you see posters on the street, but they're rarely attached to a home or business the way they are in the States. Drive through any American city in the month before an election, and every other house will have a sign in front of it. So-and-so for president, for county commissioner, town slut, etc. I also appreciate that Americans wear campaign buttons. Identifiers saying either, you and I are alike. I am a huge asshole. Or, in the case of a third-party candidate, I don't mind wasting my vote. It makes everyone so wonderfully easy to pigeonhole. I only wish that the buttons could be larger, the size of plates at least. That way you could read them from a greater distance and have more time to activate your scowl. Still though, it beats what you get in France, which is nothing. No pins, no bumper stickers. You can't ask people who they voted for either. It's considered rude. I thought about this in 2007 when Jean-Marie Le Pen won a primary in our village. After the votes were tallied, I took a walk, looking into the windows of people I thought I knew, and thinking, you? Really? Those same neighbors, unwilling to discuss their own election, were, of course, more than happy to talk about mine. After the conventions, it was all we talked about. So, who were you voting for, Obama or McCain, they wanted to know. I said to Hugh, they have to ask. I mean, really, you'd hope it would be evident. After my month in the United States, I flew back to France, arriving on the morning of November 4th, just as Americans were going to the polls. At Charles de Gaulle, I caught a cab. The driver was listening to talk radio. And during my long ride into Paris, the callers explained why the best man could never win. Americans are racist, they said. Americans are afraid of anything different. You'd think that Obama was the French candidate for president of the United States. That's how possessive and righteously disappointed everyone was. The cab driver got into it as well. Who do you think will win, he asked. And when I said Obama, he told me flat out that that was not going to happen. So then, of course, it did happen. And everyone was like, Obama! Even people I didn't know, like in stores and stuff, Obama! They cried, and you did good! I'd like to say that their tone was congratulatory, but there was something else in there as well. Not how wonderful that you have a thoughtful new president, but how wonderful that you elected the president we thought you should elect. I was in London during the inauguration and watched the ceremony on the BBC, which reminded me every 3 seconds that Barack Obama was black and would become America's first black president. At first I thought that this was for blind people. They forgot. Then it became laughable. Barack Obama, who is black, is arriving now with his black wife and two black children. America's first black first family. Which is to say, the first group of blacks elected to the White House, which is white and not black like that. It got on my nerves, but then I thought, if America had elected its first gay president, I might want to hear it a few thousand times. Take a few thousand mentions just to sink in. For me, Obama's race had nothing to do with my voting for him. I liked that he could deliver a speech. This as opposed to our last two Democratic candidates, both of whom spoke as if they were reading the words phonetically in Korean. Didn't know where to put the emphasis. In the last month of the presidential campaign, I tuned into conservative talk radio and listened as callers considered the unthinkable. One after another, they all threatened the same thing. If McCain doesn't win, I'm leaving the country. Oh, right, I said. You're going to leave and go where? Right-wing Europe? In the Netherlands now, I imagine it's legal to marry your own children. Get them pregnant, and you can abort your unborn grandbabies in a free clinic that used to be a church. The doctor might be a woman who became a man and then became a woman again. Taxpayers' dollars. But as long as she harvests the stem cells, I say, go for it. That's just me, though, being insensitive. Certain people might brand me mean-spirited, though I think that's the pot calling the kettle black. Someone votes to take away my marriage rights, and even though I don't want to get married, it tends to hurt my feelings. I guess what bugs me is that it was put to a vote in the first place. If you don't want to marry a homosexual, then don't. But what gives you the right to weigh in on your neighbor's options? It's like voting on whether or not redheads should be allowed to celebrate Christmas. Obama, too, was against gay marriage. Except for a couple of decided long shots, all the candidates were. Being for it was a kiss of death, which, again, couldn't help but tick me off. I mean, really, that's the deciding issue? Many of the Californians who voted for Proposition 8 were Democrats, and that depresses me as well. But you pick and you choose, don't you? Some things you can sit on, and others you can't. While waiting for America to come around, I listened to my French neighbors, joyous now and patting me on the back. Obama! They said. Obama! Obama! I offer in return an increasingly forced smile, thinking, oh, get your own black president. Book tour, and it's a lecture tour rather, and it's kind of unlike any tour I've ever had. 2 weeks ago, I was in the hospital. I went back to my room at like 1 o'clock in the morning, and then it felt like someone stabbed me in the side, and then was jiggling the knife handle. And it was a kidney stone. So I'd had a couple of them before, but when you have a kidney stone, you think, oh, maybe if I position myself like this, it won't hurt as much. But it does. The pain is, it's as if someone flicked a switch. It's full force the second it arrives. And nothing will, no position will lessen it, though you keep seeking that. So I went to, I was staying at a Holiday Inn, and someone asked if it was a nice one. There's no such thing. But I went down, I was doubled over in pain, and I went to the woman at the front desk, and I said, could you call me a cab to the hospital? And she called the taxi, and they said they could arrive in an hour, they'd be there in an hour. And so she called another taxi company, and they didn't even answer the phone. So she put a sign up on her desk that said, back in 15 minutes, and she drove me to the hospital. And her car was filthy. Dolphus Hotel, and my room had a billiards, it was a suite, and it had a billiards room in it. The mini bar was a full-size refrigerator. It had a living room, it had a kitchen, it had this billiards room. I walked from the kitchen to the bedroom, and I was exhausted. So this morning at, I don't know, like 9:30 or something, I hear alarms. I hear fire trucks, and I wonder what's on fire, and it was my hotel. So, and I figured that it was a drill, right? So the announcement comes over to vacate the building, and I'm on the 10th floor, so I'm going down the stairs, and then like at the 3rd floor, I hear this woman saying, calling for help. Oh my God, help me, help me. And she opened the door and came into the stairwell, and there was smoke. I mean, it was a real fire. And she just needed to be slapped. So there was just one more floor to go, and then we would be outside. She had her bathrobe on, and then as soon as she got outside, she was sobbing and calling people on the cell phone. You know what I mean? Like, it was one of those, because when I heard her cry, I thought, I can rescue someone and write about it. But really, the only thing that you could have done just is slap her. So that's a hospitalization and a fire so far on this tour, and I'm only half done. And whenever I go on tour, whenever a book comes out in another country, they always send me 10 copies, and I keep one for myself, and I give the others away. So what I've got tonight is a Bahasa copy of Me Talk Pretty One Day. That's a language they speak in the Philippines. And not to blow my own trumpet, but according to some, this book is Tarima Kasi. Normally wouldn't say that about myself, but so if you speak Bahasa, I'm going to be signing books afterwards, and the first Bahasa speaker, you can come right to the front of the line, and I will be happy to give you this book. And I also always recommend a book when I go on tour. And this is the first time I've recommended an audiobook. And generally, I recommend things that the bookstore can have, because I like to buy actual things, right? And I've never bought anything like from Amazon.com in my life. Like when all the stores are gone, I'm gonna be really mad. I like going into stores and buying things. But this book is not, this audiobook is not available in the United States. So you have to download it. You can either order it from the BBC, or you can download it from audible.com. And audible.com is it's like a website for audiobooks, and they've got like tens of thousands of audiobooks. Someone gave me a subscription to it. And what's good about Audible is that you can listen to like 3 or 4 minute snatches of the book before you decide to order it. Which is good, because sometimes you buy a book on tape and you think, oh, this reader sucks. Or what I don't like on books on tape when a man is reading, and then he does that with his voice when he says, Because he never sounds like a woman, he just sounds like a drag queen. But with Audible, you can see that that's going on and buy something else instead. But as I said, this is a book that you would either, you can either download it on Audible or you can order it from the BBC. And it's Alan Bennett's Talking Heads. And Alan Bennett is a national treasure in England. I can't really think of a writer who's more beloved in that country. And then if Americans know him at all, it's because he wrote The Madness of King George, and he won some Tony Awards for The History Boys. And he's been writing since the early 1960s. And I did some recordings for the BBC about 10 years ago, and the producer asked if I was familiar with Alan Bennett, and I said no, and so he bought me Talking Heads. And I have since then pounced on everything that Alan Bennett's ever done. Because I heard him before I read him, I want him to read everything to me. I still buy his books, just in case he ever comes to my house. You know, that I've got them. But I really want him to read to me. And Talking Heads is a series of monologues that he wrote, and they're delivered by, Alan Bennett does one of them, but the majority are delivered by actresses, by phenomenal actresses. Maggie Smith does one. Eileen Atkins does one. Patricia Routledge does the one that I was going to play a little bit of. You might know her from that show, Keeping Up Appearances. And I've listened to each of these monologues 30 times, and every time I listen, I laugh, I laugh, I laugh, and then I sob. And you could, if you write yourself, you could spend the rest of your life trying to figure out how he does it. If you read them on paper, because Talking Heads is available as a book too, but it's not fun to read. It's like reading a play. There are none of the pauses. I mean, you realize that the pauses, you know, it's just the actresses really who. Anyway, I'm just going to play a little bit of it, and you can. And again, this is Patricia Routledge.
Bit of a bombshell today. I'm just pegging up my stocking when Mr. Sotheby says, I'm afraid, Miss Fozzard, this is going to have to be our last encounter. Apparently this latest burglary's put the tin hat on things. And what with Mrs. Sotheby's mother finally going into a home, and their TV reception always being so poor, there's not much to keep them in Leeds, so they're making a bolt for it and heading off to Scarborough. Added to which, Tina, their chow, has a touch of arthritis, so the sands may help. And the upshot is they've gone in for a little semi near Peace Home Park. But, Mr. Sotheby says, none of this is of any consequence. What is important, Miss Fozzard, is what are we going to do about your feet? You've been coming to me for so long, I don't like to think of your feet falling into the wrong hands. I said, well, Mr. Sotheby, I shall count myself very lucky if I find someone as accomplished as yourself, and if I may say so, with your sense of humour, because it's very seldom we have a session in which laughter doesn't figure somewhere. He said, well, Miss Fozzard, chiropody is a small world, and I've taken the liberty of making a few phone calls and come up with two possibilities. One is a young lady over in Roundhay, who I understand is very reasonable. A woman, I said, in chiropody. Isn't that unusual? No, not nowadays, he said. The barriers are coming down in chiropody as in everything else. It's progress, Miss Fozzard. The march of. And Cindy Bickerton has her own salon. I said, Cindy, that doesn't inspire confidence. She sounds as if she should be painting nails, not cutting them. Well, he said, in that case, the alternative might be more up your street. I don't know him personally, but Mr. Dunderdale has all the right letters after his name. He's actually retired, but he still likes to take on a few selected clients to keep his hand in. However, he does live out at Lawnswood, and unless I'm very much mistaken, you're not motorized. I said, no problem. I can just bob on the 17. It's a bus I like. No, if it's all the same to you and the Equal Opportunities Board, I'll opt for Mr. Dunderdale. He said, I think it's a wise decision. Allow me. And he winked. Allow me, he said, to shake hands with your feet.
And from there, it goes to places I defy you to second guess. That's another thing that I love about Alan Bennett is that the monologues start here and then they wind up over here, but it makes perfect sense when you get there. You just never saw it coming. In that way, to me, it's like the internet. I just got the internet in June. Hugh showed me how to turn it on. We had that airport thing in our computer, so he showed me how to tune it in, right? So I'm at a place now where the rest of you were like 12 years ago. I had lunch with Bailey White the other day because I was in Florida and I think the world of her, but she still travels with a typewriter, and she said, what people will do now is they'll take a picture and use it for what they call a screensaver. We both sounded, I'm a little bit beyond her, but like all my terminology is still old, but like I like how, like I saw these Douglas Sirk movies a few weeks ago, and I noticed that Rock Hudson towered over everyone else in the movie, so I went to Google and I wanted to find out how tall he was, so I wrote in, how tall is Jesus? Google likes to second guess you. You want to know how tall Jesus is? And I thought, well, I was looking for Rock Hudson. Sure, how tall? Was, and then 45 minutes later, you're watching a video called Me Fucking Myself Up the Ass with a Carrot. Which exists. That's an actual name of this video that I saw. There's a website, and I'm offering this as a public service announcement. There's a website called XTube, okay? And people have sex and they post it, right? And it makes you understand why porn stars get the big money. Because you and I are an advertisement for love. Not for sex. And what's, like, somebody will decide, I'm going to masturbate and show anybody what it looks like. So they set up a camera, and then they masturbate, but you look at it, and you see a Christmas tree, right? In the background, and then they have left the radio on, you know? And then you realize that it's March, and you just think, shouldn't you take your Christmas tree? And everything on there is like that. Like it doesn't. The people who put the things on there, they think it's erotic, but it's not. You always wind up concentrating on the thing that you're not supposed to be concentrating on. How tall is Jesus led right to that? And it reminds me a little bit of Alan Bennett, you know, because the story starts here and then it winds up here and it makes sense. We have a few minutes here. If anybody has any questions, we could. You could. There was, like, how tall was, like, Rock Hudson? One, it said he was 6'8". And Jesus runs a gamut, too. He's like five, he's always taller than me. He's like 5'9", 5'10", and one place had him at 5'11". So there's a 3-inch span, but I'm not the kind of person, like, if I had a wish, right? If I had 10 wishes, one of them would not to be taller. If I had 100 wishes, I wouldn't even get around to that. Like, it doesn't really matter to me. Like, it never occurred to me that my life would be better if there was more of me, right? But I'm curious about how tall other people are. And I looked one day, and it was on some other website. Someone said, oh, I saw that shrimp, Anderson Cooper, on the corner of 8th Avenue and, like, 23rd Street. And I met him once, and I thought, really? And he's 5'10". Shrimp, like, how tall are you that you're calling him a shrimp? But I noticed somebody doing that to, Sarkozy in France. Somebody was saying, oh, he's just a little speck, you know, he's a tiny, he's just a little nothing. Like, how tall is he? 5'9". Well, I'm 5'5½. What does that make me? Yes. Are Amy and I friends? Yes. I mean, I don't, like, do we compete over who goes on David Letterman anymore? I hate going on TV. I'm not comfortable at all. And she is, you know, it's just her thing, so I'm really happy for her. But I don't, I don't have a list of how many times I've been on, how many times she's been on. I'll get her for going on. So, no, we're good friends. Yes. Would you continue to visit Austin after Texas secedes from the United States? Will I continue to visit Austin after Texas secedes from the United States? I saw that on the news. So that was, I guess that must be even frustrating to, like, have the memory of a great governor, you know? If you never had one, then it might not be so hard. Good one. Yes. I can't really see anything, and I just point. Sometimes somebody has their... Yes?
Sometime in the last year, I believe, you successfully stopped smoking through a program that you developed yourself with Nano. How is it going?
Oh, the question was, how's it, the not smoking, going? You know, I really have to say, about a month ago, I finished something, and I was going to start something else, and I thought, oh, I want a cigarette. But I wanted a cigarette as punctuation, you know, as a period between, and I just sat on my hands for 8 seconds, and then I haven't thought about smoking since then. It's funny how fear controls, how all-encompassing fear is, right? So I told myself all these things would happen if I ever quit smoking, and none of them happened, and it really hasn't been hard at all. I don't think other people should quit. Like, I'm not that kind of person, and I still let people smoke in my house, and I still get outraged when cigarette prices go up. But the key, actually, was to not be envious of other smokers. Like, if you were jealous of people, then that I always knew that that was going to be a problem. So the German, the wife of my German publisher, I had asked her once if her brother smoked, and she said, "Carl has finished with his smoking." So I just think of it like that. I pretend that I was assigned a certain number of cigarettes at birth, a lot of them. And if I smoked more slowly, I could still be at it, but I finished them, and that's the way I think about it. I don't really, it's funny, I just don't really think about it. And it has made it a lot easier to travel. Because if you go to the airport and let's say you're supposed to leave at 10 and then they say you're going to leave at 10:30. And so that's not enough time to go outside to have a cigarette. And then at 10:30 they say, "Oh, it's going to be 11. It's like, "God damn it, why did you tell me that?" So I'm just getting enraged. Things like that would enrage me. So it's good. I don't miss that. Like, I can still be outraged on other people's behalf, but you know how that is. It's like, "Oh, I'm so bad, I'm so sorry you were sick." You know, that you were feeling... I mean, I'm just visiting their misery. Well, I don't know that, again, I never tried to quit before, and I think that had a lot to do with it. If you tried and you failed, then when you try to quit again, you're thinking, "Well, I failed before." I just think it makes it a lot harder. And I never tried. I never even considered quitting before. Yes?
Have you gone to visit Nicaragua?
I have not gone to Nicaragua. But I went to, and I know it's a completely different story, but I went to Brazil. I had never been there before. I went to a town called Paraty, which is like on the coast. It was for a literary festival. And then I went to Rio on the way back. And all you hear is about that. They need a new press officer in Brazil, because all you hear about is people being hacked up, hacked to pieces. Obviously, that did not happen to me. I had a really wonderful time. Yes? Have I ever had some people that I've written stories about come back and find me? I try to write about people who aren't big readers. Now, this woman at the YMCA, I mean at the Holiday Inn, okay? It was so kind of her to give me a ride in the hospital. And I'll probably write about it, but her car was filthy, okay? But I think because you're talking about pain, 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 and then when you say her car was filthy, it's a release for the audience and it gets a huge laugh. And I was just thinking about that, and I thought, okay, how would she feel if she were to read this and then think, "God, you helped somebody." And then they tell the whole world that your car was filled. But I went the next morning and gave her $100. Right? Now, okay, and in my thinking, it's like I just bought the right to say that. I do think about Because, like, the New Yorker policy is that if you talk about anyone who can be identified, they have to be contacted for the story, right? So she, you know, even if I'm not describing her, if I'm saying she worked at the Holiday Inn in Mount Kisco, right, and I did get her name, so then I think about that. What, she's going to be doing her job and the phone's going to ring, and she's going to think, a fact checker from the New Yorker? Yes, is your car filthy? Like, with her on the way to the hospital, or I tried to, because when you're in pain like that, just, I said, so what do you do? What else do you do? And she had gone to film school. And I wanted to say, this would be a good start for a movie. But maybe, what if she made a movie and in which this complete asshole gets a kidney stone and she takes him to the hospital? It wouldn't hurt my feelings. I guess I think of it like, I never said she was a bad person, and I don't have a car. Maybe if I did, I would just use it as a big trash can. We don't know. And my cousin, I have a cousin who lives in Australia, and so I just wrote a little something about her, and it's the same thing. I went to Australia and I met with her, and she just taken part in the world's largest tractor pull, and she said there were over 1,000 of us in an unplowed field, and you could see the dust from space. And what do you say? I was in space and I could see dust. But I write about it in such a way that, I'm sorry, but it's just, it's a weird way to spend your time, I think. And now will it hurt her feelings if she sees it? Yeah. Maybe. But no, I think if you like doing that, driving, raising dust that can be seen from space. Maybe normal things don't affect you. You know, like maybe. One more question, yes?
Why did you start using the internet after holding out for so long?
What was it that, I mean, I had to get, I started my book tour, and then they were arranging this other tour of Brazil, and they were arranging a tour of, and a German book tour, right? So I got the email after all that time, because I had to work on these things while I was going to be traveling, and I had to, so I got that, and then that led to the internet. I think Hugh had showed me how I could look at the New York Times. I mean, I'd rather buy the real paper, so when I'm in the United States, I buy the actual paper. But Hewitt showed me how I could look at the New York Times, and so I found myself looking at that. And then, it's interesting, too, the traps you fall into. Like, one of the things about the internet that's kind of scary, I think, is that you can live in your own little news bubble, and you can only follow news that validates. You can go to sites and hate the same people that you do, right? And so you can live in a little comfortable world. So I didn't want to get into that. There was something specific that, I just can't remember the answer. I mean, there was something more specific than that, that made me, but I was always, like I told myself, I've been writing these stories about animals, right? So I told myself, well, if I need to know things about aphids, right? So I wrote this whole thing about aphids, and I didn't realize that ants, I had an ant eating an aphid, but actually, ants drink life-giving juice from the asses of aphids. want to kill them. They just like put a spigot in them and drink life-giving juice. So in order to learn that, I went to the library and read a bunch of books. And then then I needed some information on something else, and Hugh showed me. Hugh just punched into the computer, and it's like, oh, there's what you need right there. And I always believed in the past it was important to go to the library, and I love libraries, but in London I go to the library all the time, but in Paris, I don't even know how to go to the library. So I think actually that was it, like trying to learn more about animals in order to write stories about them. And I realized I could do it at the press of a button instead of waiting to go to London and then going to the library. If anybody else has a question or would like a book signed, I'll be out in the lobby. And again, for anyone who speaks Bahasa, language of... of Indonesia, I'm happy to give you this book. And Alan Bennett's Talking Heads, it's superb. Thank you very much.